It's quite hard doing this under a duvet.
The CMU podcast in association with 7Digital.
This week, Amazon Music Unlimited, the Isle of Wight Festival, and Insane Clown Posse. It's the CMU podcast, looking back at the last week in the music business. I'm Andy Malt, editor of CMU. With me, sort of, is Chris Cook, business editor of CMU. I say sort of because I'm not in the studio this week.
Now, Andy was so pleased with the echo effect that we had on last week's edition of the podcast, which we recorded in a different location because it was a special edition. He was so pleased with the echo effect that he decided he wasn't going to come into London this week and he was going to record it from a cupboard. So, because we've got a long history of that working well on this podcast. So, Andy Malt is coming to you live from a cupboard, whereas I am in the super well-built, I'm trying to think of an adjective, perfect acoustic. That's the adjective I needed. Perfect acoustic of the studio where we normally record the podcast in Shoreditch in London. So my bits are going to sound remarkable. But Andy insisted on having a little bit more echo on his voice.
Yes. Well, I shouldn't have any echo on my voice because I am under a duvet.
You're under a duvet. Revealing the high-tech techniques that we employ to make this the best possible podcast. Are there any police helicopters buzzing around your house?
No, but I did change room because you could hear cars going past.
No room for cars on this podcast. We do not want vehicles in the background. I should say, actually, it's my fault that Andy's not in the studio for the podcast.
Yeah. Declare. Yeah, you should say that.
Because, as we mentioned on last week's podcast, I am going to the MAMA conference in Paris. I am leaving this evening, by which I mean it is currently Wednesday when we're recording this. So usually we record the podcast on a Thursday. It's a Wednesday record because I need to go to Paris this evening. That's why Andy isn't in the studio. It also means, as we always say when we record the podcast early, if a major news story breaks tomorrow, Thursday, we won't be talking about it. We will not cover it in this edition of the podcast. We won't cover it in next week's podcast either. We will deny it ever happened. So let's just hope nothing major happens in the world of music tomorrow, Thursday, before you hear this podcast. Hopefully on Friday. Last week's podcast ended up going out a little bit late due to various technical things. But I'm sure nobody noticed. I don't even know why I've mentioned that. I've ruined the illusion that people were just thinking it was their computer that wasn't working or it was their podcast app that wasn't downloading. But hey, normal service resumed this week. I'm in a studio, normal format. We're going to go out on time. And thanks to a duvet, it will be as if Andy is here.
Well, fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah. So what have we got coming up in this podcast? We're going to talk about the Isle of Wight Festival.
We are.
We're going to talk about Insane Clown Posse.
Bizarrely, yes.
And their view on the crazy clown epidemic sweeping America. But first, let's talk about Amazon Music Unlimited.
I have a good segue for our first story. Do you want my segue for the first story?
Well, I've already started it, but go on.
Talking of echoes, do you see that? Talking of echoes.
Yeah, I see.
Amazon have launched their streaming music service, including the discount package for users of the Amazon Echo speaker device thing.
Yeah, that's a thing.
It is a thing.
But yeah, like you said, Amazon has launched Amazon Music Unlimited, which is Amazon's Spotify and Apple Music rival, which has been rumoured for a little while.
In fact, it's been rumoured for such a long while, and indeed nearly every bit of information about this product has been doing the rounds for at least a few weeks now, that when the press release finally came in, and I was writing the story, it was like, well, I feel like I should be explaining lots of stuff here, but I've written it all before because we knew what was going. The precise price points we didn't know, but pretty much everything else we did know. So, obviously, Amazon is already in the streaming music game in that if you are an Amazon Prime customer in certain countries, including the UK, like myself, are you an Amazon Prime customer? You are, aren't you?
I am, yeah.
Then as an Amazon Prime customer in the UK and some other countries, you already have access to streaming music alongside the video on demand and the e-books. Do you ever download any e-books from Amazon Prime?
Nope.
No, neither do I, but apparently they're there. And, of course, the free delivery, which is the real reason everyone signs up to Amazon Prime. But in amongst all of that, there is streaming music. However, although that is on-demand streaming music, it's not personalised radio, it's not a complete catalogue service. So I think there are a few million tracks in there. I've not counted, but certainly it was a few million when they launched. Whereas, obviously, a Spotify, Apple Music, Deezer, Tidal now have something in the region of about 40 million tracks available on-demand. So the music available in Amazon Prime is a limited catalogue service, and you don't get all the big new releases. So whereas most new releases, unless Adele sang it, or they've done an exclusive with Apple or Tidal, but generally speaking, new releases these days are dished out to all of the streaming services, but generally speaking, not the Amazon Prime streaming service, because it's a limited catalogue service, because you're not actually paying for it. You're getting it in amongst your Amazon Prime subscription, which in the UK is 80 quid, isn't it, in the UK? So
yeah, something like that.
For less than a Spotify subscription, you're getting some streaming music, as well as the video on demand, as well as the free delivery, and as well as those ebooks that we all like to read. So that's where Amazon currently are on the streaming space, but this Amazon Music Unlimited, and I suppose the unlimited bit, you might think that's because in the past there was some, I don't know, some limits to how many times you could listen to a track, but the reason why they're calling it Amazon Music Unlimited is because this is not a limited catalogue service. So basically, they will have pretty much the same catalogue as Spotify, Tidal, and all the others, about 40 million tracks. Although, I mean, actually, it should be not limited rather than unlimited, because that's clearly not every single record that has ever been released.
Well, no, but unlimited in the world of tech is often used incorrectly. Like, you know, unlimited mobile phone data plans often mean limited quite heavily.
And of course, you know, there are companies called Unlimited Media who only actually own 3 Media. So yes, I think we can all agree that generally speaking, the word unlimited is misused. But basically, this is Amazon going head to head for the first time with Spotify and Apple Music, with basically the same service. So the 40 million odd tracks, I'm saying 40 million, I don't actually know. I should have read that bit of the press release more closely, but pretty much the same catalogue of music. Actually, I saw somebody tweeting that they've got more music than Apple Music. Don't know what that means. But all the music that you would get from the other services are available through this new Amazon streaming platform, which, like all the others, is retailing at $9.99 a month, currently only available in the US, due to roll out in the UK later this year. So in that respect, it's just another streaming service. However, what is interesting is that they do have these other pricing options if you are an Amazon Prime customer, or if you're willing to have a certain limitation on where you listen to the music.
Yeah, so if you're just the average person on the street who is wandering around not paying Amazon for a free delivery service or a speaker, you can pay $9.99 a month like you could any other service. If you're a Prime customer, however, you can pay $7.99 a month for this new music service. So that's a nice little discount. Or if you're willing to have it tied exclusively to your Amazon Echo speaker, then it's only $3.99 a month.
Yes, and in some ways it is the cheaper $3.99 element to all of this that makes this an interesting launch, rather than it just being yet another $10 a month streaming service entering the market. In that, and I'm sure we've talked about this on the podcast before, I've certainly written about it on numerous occasions in the CMU Daily and also in CMU Trends, is that there's been this conversation in the music industry for a few years now, and particularly the last 18 months, about the fact that we need a bigger variety of streaming services, different packages, different price points for different kinds of consumers. Because really, as it currently stands, although lots of streaming services have launched in different countries in recent years, there are basically two services, which is you either tolerate ads and you get it for free, whether that's through Spotify free, Deezer free, or through like a YouTube, or you pay $10 a month, you don't have any ads, and you get full mobile functionality and all of the other stuff. And then I suppose there's the third option with some services that if you pay double, £20 a month, $20 a month, you then get the super high quality streams. But that's basically it. And there's been all that research to suggest that £120 a year for recorded music for the vast majority of consumers is too much. And however good that service might be, and however much music there may be, and however brilliant it is for core music fans, for the average consumer who used to buy 2, maybe 3 CDs a year, it's a lot of money to spend on recorded music. So therefore, you're never going to convert most consumers into subscribing to a £10 a month premium service. So do you just let them sit on the free services? But as we all know, we don't make much money out of the free services, because there's a finite amount of advertising money. And generally speaking, the royalties you get from the free services are tiny compared to the premium services. So really, we want to convert more people into being paying consumers, but we need a lower price point. And the price point they've gone for here is $4 a month. I assume it will probably be £4 a month when it launches over here in the UK. But then the question is, but what is it about a £4 service, a £6 service, an £8 service that is better than free, but less good than the £10 premium. And that's various people have dabbled with different ideas. And obviously what Amazon are doing here is they're saying, well, if you bundle it with a Prime subscription, then you get it for £8. And in some ways, I suppose that's just a more upfront expression of the bundles that do already exist in the premium market, in that actually a lot of people get their streaming in with like a Vodafone account or an Orange account or whatever. And behind the scenes, they are paying a discount on the £10 a month. So in some ways, that's just a more upfront way of doing bundling. Whereas the £4, $4 service, that is interesting because what they're saying is this is a way of hitting people who won't pay £10 a month. And the limitation, and it's quite a big limitation, is not the content you get, not the functionality in terms of is it on demand, is it personalised radio, but that it will only work on your Echo speaker. So the super duper smart speaker thing that Amazon launched last year and everyone seems to love it. And you basically shout stuff at it, don't you? And it plays music and stuff. So the question is, does that consumer exist? Are there people out there who are happy to listen to the radio or free streaming when they're in the car or they're on the move or they're in the kitchen, but a few times a week they want to sit down like you would have done in the olden days with your hi-fi to play CDs. They want to sit down with decent sound quality and then have the on-demand experience, and they reckon for that they would pay £4 a month, whereas they would never pay £10 a month. Does that consumer exist, and are there enough of them? But it is interesting, obviously, what Amazon has, like Apple, when they enter the market, is a massive existing customer base that they can sell this to. And it will be interesting to see whether or not there is a market for that sort of limited functionality, but at a considerably cheaper price point and with none of the adverts that come with the free services.
Yeah, because, I mean, well, Amazon does have its other streaming service already, which you mentioned, being the one that sort of just gets bundled with the Prime membership, which, you know, is a limited service. And there was an interview with Martin Goldschmidt from Cook and Vinyl this week where he was claiming that Amazon was serving up more streams than Apple Music. Exactly what he meant by that wasn't entirely clear.
But, and that was specifically in the US, wasn't it?
Whereas in the US, yeah.
Amazon Prime Music has been going the longest in the US and actually launched, I think, before Apple Music over there. And Amazon have always been a little bit unhelpful in quite how many Amazon Prime customers have actually downloaded the music app and are using it. I must admit, I haven't. I have downloaded the video on demand app and I do use that quite regularly, but I've never got around to downloading the music app. So how many people are using it, we don't know. Although that was an interesting statement that it seems to be certainly in the US, Amazon Prime customers have embraced music when it comes in the package for free. But the question is, will those customers upsell? Will they think that $8 a month is good to get a much, much bigger catalogue, or would they be willing to lock it to their Echo device, assuming they have such a thing or will buy such a thing, and then pay the $4 a month? These are all unknowns.
Yes, they are. But Amazon's VP of Amazon Music, Steve Boom, which let's just take a moment to note what a great name that is, he reckons he knows what's going to happen. He said in a statement that the first phase of growth in music streaming was driven almost entirely by smartphones. We believe pretty strongly that the next phase in growth in streaming is going to come from the home.
Hence locking it to the device.
Yeah, speakers that you can shout at. He also said that we're moving music away from a one-size-fits-all approach. We are the ones who have been pushing this the hardest.
And on that, he's definitely right. And as I say, I think...
Or at all.
Well, I suppose there are... I mean, there have been a couple of people...
Well, it's free and premium, I suppose that's... Yeah.
There was Cure, is that how we decided that was being pronounced? That US service that never really got off the ground, that was trying to do sort of middle price services. Audio, yeah. A long list of successful companies that have tried this. Audio.
Bloom.
Bloom, various defunct services have tried it. And of course, at one point here in the UK, Spotify had a $4.99 subscription if you were willing to only listen on your PC. So it wouldn't work on your iPhone, it wouldn't work on your iPad. But then they got rid of that, I think, because they launched it just as smartphones were becoming mainstream and it suddenly became, well, who would want access to a service just through their PC? Clearly, they'd want it through their smartphone. I suppose what Amazon are hoping here is, well, while that might be true, because the Echo speaker is more like a hi-fi experience, perhaps they can make a distinction there. So we'll see, I guess. The challenge for everybody in the coming years, though, is, as I've said several times, everybody agrees we need a bigger range of services, and it's great that Amazon are experimenting here. But at the same time, what the music industry doesn't want, and this is something we sort of talked about with David Lowry when we had that interview with him earlier in the summer, is what the music industry doesn't want is the people who've already signed up to the £10 a month service, or any of the people who might potentially sign up to the £10 a month service in the coming months, We don't want any of those people to go, oh, do you know what? I'll go for this cheaper service. So it's sort of doing the balancing act of continuing to sign up as many people as we can over here at £10 a month, because that is what is driving the growth in both the streaming market, but crucially in the wider record industry as well. But at the same time, in order to go truly mainstream, we need to get these sort of mid-price services off the ground too. So it will be interesting to see what the uptake on this is and whether or not it sort of sets a template that other services, whether that's Spotify or Apple, or new entrants into the market may pursue in the coming years.
Well, still to come, we've got Insane Clown Posse, and I look through some of this week's other music business stories in brief. But now, the Isle of Wight Festival, which might not happen in 2017. Are you sad?
It would have very little effect on my year, I have to admit. Although, you know, it is a popular festival, and it's a festival that lots of industry people go to and lots of big artists play. So it would be a relatively large absence from the festival calendar if, for some reason, the 2017 edition did not go ahead.
Yeah, so, well, obviously, it's an iconic name in festivals. It ran for 3 years, 1968 to 1970, and
it is stopped. I always think it's interesting that, yeah, the Isle of Wight Festival is seen as being this legendary, and actually, of those three, one of them in particular is sort of the legendary year that was a real moment in sort of rock history, if you like. But then there was, like, as you say, 30 years without an event, and then the Isle of Wight resurrected it because it was still this famous brand from the past. But I don't know, when you talk about it, sometimes people talk about it as if like Glastonbury, it has been going. Well, even Glastonbury, actually, there was the original festival was then nothing for 10 years, and then it resurrected. But people sort of talk about it as if it's been happening every year for like 4 decades, which it hasn't. Yeah. Having said that, the all-new Isle of Wight Festival has now been going for quite a long time. It's over 10 years, I think, isn't it, that the modern incarnation has been running.
Yeah, the council revived it in 2002. It's been run by a company called Solo for at least a decade now, I think. And it's that company, Solo, who they put forward a proposal to the council that the fee they have to pay to rent Seaclose Park, where the event takes place, be waived next year because they're trying to cut costs.
I suppose it's from what I can take from the various reports that have been on this, there's an element of, in essence, it's the Isle of Wight's festival. So in essence, it belongs to the Isle of Wight Council, although everyone in the industry thinks of it as being a Solo event because they have run it.
No, Solo runs it on behalf of the council.
But I suppose there is that thing that, in essence, it is the council's festival. It takes place on a property owned by the council, yet the festival has to pay 55 grand in order to use that site. So I think that's almost an element of where it's come from, is the promoters of the festival are saying that for various reasons we need to cut our costs, and it sort of seems an obvious cost, given that ultimately we are working for the council, is that we don't have to then pay to use the site that the council owns. But this has all been in the news this week because the council were meant to be considering this, and then there was some long report about why this proposal was coming forward, and also about the Isle of Wight Festival in general and the festival market in general.
Yeah, so the council commissioned this report to aid their ruling on this, which they were supposed to debate on Thursday, but that won't happen now, as we'll get on to. But basically, they published this report, and in because they're a council and they want to be transparent, they published the report on their website, which then journalists like us picked up on. And the report basically said, you know, it had a wider view of the overall festival market, and was saying that the festival market's become more competitive since they signed their original agreement with Solo, which is due to run until 2019. They're saying, you know, a lot of festivals are struggling, a lot of festivals have gone out of business, a lot of festivals have seen ticket sales fall. And so it's overall a more competitive market, and so Solo need to reduce costs in order to remain a competitive event. A lot of write-ups, not ours, I would add, said that the Isle of Wight wanted to reduce this cost because it had seen ticket sales fall. And the festival and the council said that is not the case. It's actually seen ticket sales go up, but it's just more difficult to run a festival in this day and age.
Yeah, so I suppose what they were saying is ticket sales are still as high as they ever were. In fact, they've gone up, but the costs of putting on a festival for various reasons have gone up in recent years. And so that's one of the reasons why they need to cut costs. And the report said, you know, that this proposal of not paying a fee to the council for the use of the site was one of a number of cuts that the promoters were looking into to try and make the festival more efficient. I suppose one interesting thing was, I mean, obviously, if the costs of producing the festival have gone up, well, you put the ticket price up. And they covered that in the report, didn't they?
Yes. Yeah, they said they were basically two options either you reduce costs or you put the ticket prices up. And the festival said they didn't want to pass their increased costs on to the consumer, so they were going to try to cut costs instead.
But I have to say, you know, if the costs have gone up, then ticket price should go up.
I mean, that is how pricing works,
isn't it? That's sort of how it works. And I suppose that is, although, as I say, they were keen to stress that various people who twisted this to say, oh, ticket sales are down at the Isle of Wight Festival, that is incorrect. Although there is the sort of association of saying, OK, you might be saying we don't want to put ticket prices up because we don't think the punter should have to pay more. But then, well, that's how it works. Unless you think by putting the ticket price up, then you would struggle to sell your tickets. And festival ticket pricing is a complicated business, but it may well be, OK, if we had to put £20 on every ticket in order to cover these increasing costs, would we then take a hit? And would that see some people who come religiously might say, oh, when I was one with festivals, I mean, I suppose a journalist, we don't pay to go to stuff. I never know whether, are people that aware of how much a festival costs? If a festival adds a £10 increase from one year to the next, do people remember what they paid a year ago? But I suppose people aren't earning much more these days, are they? So perhaps punters can't afford if the ticket price goes up.
I mean, there are always stories. Whenever Glastonbury goes up, there are stories about it.
People moaning about it.
But whenever Glastonbury does anything, there are stories about it. So yes, maybe that's not a great marker.
But as you alluded to, there was meant to be a council meeting this week to consider this report and consider this request. There was a sort of a compromise, wasn't there, where they were saying, well, we don't want to waive the £55,000 entirely, but if you would take over responsibility for some of the things that we, the council, do when the festival is on, like traffic management and portable toilets and stuff like that, sort of off-site at the traffic hubs, then we could remove what it costs us to do that from the £55,000. So you'd only end up paying £13,000 in cash. So that was a precise proposal that the council were going to discuss this week. But then seemingly because of the reporting about this, and in particular the report saying that ticket sales were down, they've decided to call all of that off for reasons we can't quite understand.
No, it's a bit weird because they've said, due to these the media reports getting it wrong about their ticket sales, they've withdrawn this proposal to have this fee waived. And instead, Solo and the council will work on alternative ways to reduce costs. I'm not really sure why they can't just go ahead with the proposal. You know, they've put out a statement saying, oh, sorry, no, you were wrong on that. Ticket sales are fine. Well, why not just carry on? I did ask for a clarification on
that. But we're yet to have that.
The festival's PR, but I've not had anything.
Of course, you know, we are putting this together a day early, so perhaps they'll get back to us on Thursday afternoon and that'll be the thing we denied ever happened. But as it currently stands, Solo had apparently told the council that they needed all of this sorted by the end of the month so that they can know that their budgets for 2017 are going to work and they can start putting everything into place, making commitments and sort of paying advances to artists and all that sort of stuff. And if they can't get it sorted by the end of the month, well, it again gets to the point in the year where it's like, well, there's not now time for us to have everything sorted by next summer. And then the council were saying, and if Solo say we can't do it in 2017 on this budget, it's unlikely you're going to find another promoter who would come in. And even if you could find a promoter who would come in at that late a stage, arguably, can they really get the event together ready for next summer if they were coming
in? Because
there's
various licenses they'd need to get, the company itself would need to get, that the council doesn't have in place already itself, that they have to be locked to the company, and they've spread out from Seaclose Park and they're using other land, and that complicates things. And just the time it would take to get the clearance to use all that land would probably be a bit too tight of a turnaround.
But we will keep our eye on the Isle of Wight Council's website and see how this develops, and if we have word in the next couple of weeks of whether or not there will indeed be an Isle of Wight Festival in 2017.
Before we get on to our last story, we'll just run through a few of the other big stories in the music business this week in brief. Following Spotify's launch in Japan, Merlin has now opened an office in Japan too.
Which makes sense. Spotify finally arrived in the Japanese market. And to be fair, that wasn't really Spotify being slow. It was getting the licenses sorted in Japan, which until relatively recently wasn't that keen on downloads, let alone moving over to streaming. But then,
I think you'll find there's still a large section of the Japanese industry that is anti-digital entirely.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see quite how much J-pop is on these services, given that they don't really seem to have branched beyond the compact disc yet. But when Apple Music launched globally, it launched in Japan, second biggest recorded music market. Also, the Line messaging app added a streaming music service, I think that was last year. But it has taken a long time for the streaming music market to get off the ground in this market because the industry didn't initially want to do the deals. Spotify has now gone live. And so Merlin, which represents the indie labels, has now opened an office in Tokyo, which makes sense because it seems like finally the streaming market is starting to take off and hopefully will explode and boom in Japan, just like it has in the US and in Europe. And so it makes sense for the indie labels and the organisation that represents about half of the indie label sector when it comes to streaming deals to have an office on the ground, although they were very keen to stress that although it's based in Tokyo and it is capitalising on the arrival of streaming in Japan, this office will also have an oversight over the wider Asian market, where they have Merlin have done a number of deals in the last couple of years. And in some of those countries, in particularly Southeast Asia, there are some services that we've never heard of. Well, I've heard of them, but which don't exist here in Europe, which are gaining traction in that market, in addition to Apple Music and Spotify and the big global services that we all know over here.
Yeah, and it's going to be run by Haji Taniguchi, who used to be the president of the publishing side of AVEX, which is the fourth major label in Japan, because Japan's major label system is so different to everywhere else's.
And of course, the rumour was a couple of years ago that it was AVEX along with Sony Music Japan, Sony Music Japan being a separate company to the rest of Sony Music, still owned by Sony Corp, but a separate company. It was AVEX and Sony Music Japan who were the big holdouts on letting the likes of Spotify come to market. Meanwhile, the Japanese versions of Universal and Warner have been sort of lobbying to allow the Spotifys of the world to go live in Japan in recent years. So yes, anyway, be interesting to see what happens with streaming in that market, both in the terms of Spotify and however they can sign people up, and from the indie label perspective, Merlin doing more deals in that part of the world.
Yeah, no, well, next we've got a good old lawsuit. Ed Sheeran's lawyers have been complaining, which is always fun.
This is one of my favourite stories of the year so far, I think. So you remember earlier in the year, Ed Sheeran was sued. This is one of two lawsuits, song theft, plagiarism lawsuits that Ed Sheeran is currently defending. This is the one where he was accused of ripping off a song made famous by Matt Cardle for his hit Photograph. And the songwriters of the track Amazing, which is the song that he's accused of ripping off, have hired the same lawyer that represents the Marvin Gaye family in the famous Blurred Lines plagiarism case. So it's interesting before we even start, but a very amusing response from Ed Sheeran's defence. And actually, there are loads of defendants on this, because there's Ed, and then there is his collaborator on the song, Johnny McDade from Snow Patrol, and then an assortment of music publishers. So there's lots of defendants on this lawsuit. And the response from those defendants to the court, responding to the litigation that was filed earlier this year, is what a waffly piece of nonsense this lawsuit is. Who's got time to read all of this tedious waffle? Can't the people who are representing the songwriters of Amazing just write out in a couple of really concise paragraphs what they're banging on about, and then we can properly defend? And then they also said that there are so many defendants, they need to be much more specific about exactly what allegations they're making about which of the 11 defendants. And they also said, which I must admit occurred to me at the time, nearly everybody involved in this case is British. And although there's some global music publishers involved, it's generally the UK divisions that are involved. And yet they've sued in California, possibly to try and piggyback on the precedent set in the Blurred Lines case. But they were basically saying jurisdiction, think this case, if there's going to be a case, should be fought in the UK. So it was an amusing response to what was already an interesting piece of litigation that continues to work its way through the court.
Death Cab for Cutie kicked off a new project called 30 Days, 30 Songs, which is releasing a song a day in the run-up to the US presidential election, which is anti-Donald Trump. I'm amazed they could only find 30. Because this is the same people who did a thing called 90 Days, 90 Reasons, where they gave 90 reasons to vote for Obama in the last election. So I'm sure they could have found 90 songs.
I'm sure they could have gone had they wanted to. Just before we started recording this podcast, I saw a headline coming in that Donald Trump had just told his supporters to remember to vote on the 28th of November, which is like 3 weeks after the election. So perhaps they will have to provide another... if he believes that the election is 2 weeks after it really is, perhaps I'll have to find another 14 sneaky tracks to put in at the end. So yes, go and check out those. By the time this podcast goes out, presumably there will be three or four available to listen to.
Yeah, and sticking with the US presidential election, or at least US politics, WikiLeaks has published a load of Hillary Clinton campaign emails that were leaked, and amongst them is two emails from former Blink-182 guitarist Tom DeLonge emailing Clinton's campaign director, John Podesta, about UFOs.
So we know he's a bit nutty about UFOs and all stuff like that. And he's talked about that before and he's done stuff around that before. And it turns out that this Hillary Clinton advisor is also
he's big into UFOs. Yeah.
Big on UFOs. So they'd clearly been having some conversations. But was it that Tom DeLonge had interviewed this political guy for something?
So it's not clear if he ever actually responded to either of these emails. But it's basically Tom DeLonge saying, oh, I've got these guys you should speak to. They're high-level guys on all this UFO cover-up stuff. You should definitely meet with them. I mean, John Podesta said earlier this year that he'd convinced Hillary Clinton, or he thought he'd convinced Hillary Clinton to declassify emails about UFOs if she becomes president. He also said that he used to work for Obama, and when he left his job with him, he said that his greatest regret was not convincing him to declassify these files. So you can see why, you know, he'd be someone that Tom DeLonge would be keen to be in touch with. But other than the fact that he seems to have been interviewed by him at some point, whether they actually got into a correspondence, we don't know.
But proof that if you are a fan of conspiracy theories, you don't have to vote for Donald Trump, king of the conspiracy theories.
Yeah,
there are conspiracy theory freaks turnaround in the Clinton camp too.
I think the turnaround already happened. But we'll see. There's still however many days left.
Depending on who you ask, yeah.
So to check out all those stories in full, you should go to the podcast page, completemusicupdate.com/podcast. You'll find the show notes for this show and links to all of those stories. And finally, this week, we've got the real big story of the week, besides the looming downfall of Western civilization.
Yeah, you mean the big news story across the board, not just a big music news story, but we've managed to find
the
music
The big
angle.
News story across the globe is that some people have seen some clowns. It's clowns everywhere. They're all over the place.
I was doing one of my PR training courses this week, which involved going through all the newspapers. And sure enough, in all the tabloids, there were massive photos of people in dark places dressed as clowns, supposedly frightening people. So this is truly now a phenomenon that began in the US, I believe, and then arrived in Canada and is now happening in the UK. And I don't quite understand it. I don't think I need to understand it, except that we have a music angle to this story, courtesy of Time magazine.
Yeah, Time magazine decided that it needed an editorial on the subject. And Stephen King has already ruled himself out in a tweet saying it was a bit of a distraction and something a bit silly.
He has no interest in commenting on it, basically.
They went for the next best thing, which of course is Insane Clown Posse.
Of course. Why wouldn't you want Insane Clown Posse to come and comment on this story?
Exactly. And I can see why, you know, that would seem like a fun idea. It was a fun idea. Though I imagine, you know, they thought that they'd just get some waffle about clowns, which they kind of did. But Violent J from the duo wrote a quite confusing, angry and at some points unsettlingly poignant article.
Now, if the people at Time magazine read their CMU Daily, they would know that Insane Clown Posse have had their own grievances with the American establishment in recent years, because we've been covering that as it has been developing.
Yes. So in 2011, Insane Clown Posse's fans, all of them, were classified as a gang, a dangerous gang.
This was on an FBI list or something.
Yeah. And they've been trying to get the Juggalos, as they're called, removed from this list ever since.
On the basis that being a fan of a musical outfit shouldn't mean that you fulfill the criteria of being a member of a dangerous gang.
No. And so the article was largely focused on that, really. It's kind of started off talking about, basically, he started off talking about this clown epidemic and then immediately dismissed it as a stupid media thing and started talking about their own problems with the FBI. And then kind of twisted it round to be about, you know, the society as it stands today. He said, there's a whole army of scary, terrifying and dangerous clowns out there in this country trying to suppress the rights of thousands of people to exercise the most basic part of the Declaration of Independence, which evokes the freedom to life, liberty and the pursuit of happiness. The only difference is these clowns don't wear grease paint.
So by that, he means the establishment and the wilder political communities that are out there.
Yeah, and he was talking about, you know, the prevalence of police brutality that's been blowing up over the last year. And he's basically saying that there's a lot of scarier people out in the world who are running things than some people who are dressing up as clowns and standing in parks.
So what started out as a silly column about a silly story, he managed to turn into an angry rant about his own problem, or his fans' problem, I suppose, with regards to this gang listing, and then a general political commentary on the state of the universe in 2016. I met one of insane clown posse once. I don't know which one it was, though. It was quite a long time ago. It was when we were first setting up CMU, and Alistair, who I set CMU up with, was a fan of Insane Clown Posse, and he managed to arrange an interview. I think for the radio station that he was working for at the time. I don't think it was for CMU. I can't quite remember. It's possible that Fraser, who also set up CMU, was there. But I remember because he was a fan, he arranged to do the interview face-to-face rather than on the phone. And so the only reason I went was because we were going to have dinner afterwards. I didn't really bother about meeting one of Insane Clown Posse. But we were going for dinner afterwards, so I said, oh, well, I'll meet you for the interview. It was in one of the hotels on, I think it's the big hotel on Kensington High Street. And we went up to the guy's room and interviewed him in his room. But obviously the Insane Clown Posse's thing is that they're always in costume, aren't they? And they have their face painted. But he couldn't be bothered to do that for the interview. So he just wore like a hockey mask so that we couldn't see what he looked like, but he wasn't actually like he would be on stage. And then as we walked into the room, Alistair had a Polaroid camera with him, if you can remember what those are, because he liked to take Polaroid photos of everyone he interviewed. And he sort of thrust the camera into my hands and then introduced me to Insane Clown Posse as being, oh, this is our photographer. I said, oh, I'm the photographer. So then at the end of the interview, the guy from Insane Clown Posse said, well, are you going to take my photo? He's like, oh, right, yeah, I'm going to take your photo. But then I didn't know how to use the camera because it was like a really complicated Polaroid camera. And so then it was quite embarrassing for me having been introduced as the photographer, to then have to say to Alistair, how does this camera work? But I took the photo, and I'm sure it was a fantastic photo, even though he wasn't actually properly in costume. But those were before the days that being an Insane Clown Posse fan made you a listed member of a dangerous gang. So they were happy, more innocent times, I think.
Yes, maybe there are times that we can return to at some point in the near future.
Maybe.
Maybe.
If we all hide under duvets, perhaps the world will become a better place. How has been your hour under a duvet for the benefit of the acoustics of the CMU podcast?
It's been unusual.
Well, why don't you wrap up this edition and then you can be released from your duvet-like prison?
Yes, well, that's the end of the podcast. Why don't you now go and listen to some music? Because that's more fun. You can listen to some playlists that we've made on Spotify. If you search CMUHQ, you'll find our playlists. Why not listen to the CMU approved in 2016 playlist? Recent tracks on there come from Girl Ray and Menace Beach. This podcast is presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
Yes. Sorry, I stopped listening to you for a second. What were you saying?